This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about a new article from researchers on the country's response to the COVID-19 pandemic, what it reveals about our public health systems, and what could make things better. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we will do our best to get it into the conversation today. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're joined by three guests. Brian Dixon is Director of Public Health Informatics at the Regenstrief Institute and Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the IUPUI School of Public Health. Great to have you back, Brian Dixon.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Matt.
Paul Halverson is Founding Dean of the Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. Welcome to you, Paul.
Greetings.
And Virginia Kane is Director and Chief Medical Officer for the Marion County Public Health Department. Virginia, great to have you on.
Thank you so much.
Brian, we'll get into a lot of the details throughout the show today, but let's start with a general statement. How would you characterize the United States' response to the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, overall, I think our response has been pretty poor, especially at the beginning of the pandemic.
And short answer, just and why is that? Why have we not done so well?
Well, I think our public health system, especially at the federal level, was very slow to respond. We were slow to begin offering testing to individuals, particularly in cities that were hit hard early on in the pandemic. We also were very slow to instigate what we call non-pharmaceutical interventions, right? So the lockdowns and the mask ordinances and those sorts of things happened at a much slower pace than what should have been put in place.
Well, what do you think were some of the reasons for that? I mean, this is a novel disease, and so testing had to be figured out. Of course, we could point to elsewhere in the world. They sort of had things figured out perhaps a little before we did. We took pages from that. And so then I don't know why, I guess, did it seem, or has it seemed to you as a professional in this field, that the United States has really, really fallen short of what the rest of the world has done?
Well, I think there's two main reasons for it. So the first is that we really have a historic lack of funding for public health in the United States, especially compared to other countries. We spend very little on public health as opposed to a lot on health care when people are sick. So we really have a sick care system and not really a sort of health and well-being system in the country. And I think that chronic underinvestment has really led to a very fragmented public health system, so that local health departments are often, reliant on federal or state health departments for assistance, and those state health departments are reliant on the federal health system for assistance, especially in times of need. And we saw all sorts of, in this pandemic, confusion and challenges in getting the personal protective equipment that was needed and the testing supplies that were needed and other resources that were needed by the local and state health departments in the wake of the crisis compared to what also we needed for our frontline healthcare workers.
Can we point to a country that maybe is doing things a little bit better with respect to public health and look at how the pandemic has affected them versus us? Because it seems when you say that some of those factors aren't directly connected. But really, when we're talking about healthcare, it's kind of all connected. So when we look at other countries that are doing it better, what do we see as far as the results when it comes to specifically how they've responded to COVID-19?
Sure. So I think there are several countries in the world that have responded quicker and better than the United States. Canada is one. South Korea is another. We could also look at, New Zealand, for example. And in each of these cases, the federal government was very quick to jump onto the WHO bandwagon in terms of declaring it a national crisis and mobilizing testing. Even, even as the tests were kind of, you know, very early on in their kind of development, they nonetheless embraced testing and rolled out tests to, you know, hundreds of thousands of people well before the United States hit those same benchmarks. We also saw in those countries that they put severe lockdowns in place earlier on when cases were first detected in their countries, and that they had very uniform approaches to those policies. So for example, in the United States, every state kind of was left to their own devices, so to speak, to determine what their policies were going to be with respect to lockdowns and, essential workers and those classifications and everything. Whereas we saw in other countries, it was very uniform. Like in Canada, all the provinces, implemented the same kinds of interventions at the same time. And people were very, also the people in those countries were very adherent to those policies. They stayed home. In the United States, there was a lot of resistance against those public health measures when they were rolled out. And we did not see that in some of these other countries.
Paul Halverson, let's get to this. What is Public Health 3.0?
Well, Public Health 3.0 is a sort of a conception of moving forward with a public health system much more robust, much more focused on strategically changing the culture of health in the United States. It was actually designed by people who had gone through emergencies and had seen crisis after crisis. And we recognize that if we're going to be effective in public health, it has to move beyond the health department, the sort of classic brick and mortar place where people receive various services and where our public health professionals are headquartered. We need a public health system that really involves all of the sectors. Each part of our society needs to be part of a larger health system, if you will, with our hospitals, our the health department, but also in engaging with education and transportation and a whole host of other organizations, businesses, and so forth. I mean, it's a recognition, frankly, Matt, that health is more than just going to the doctor. It's more than just waiting for a major event. But essentially, health is the key to practically all that we do. And so a proponent or a key aspect of Public Health 3.0 is this notion around health in all policies. That is to say that regardless of what we're doing, there's an aspect of health that impacts us. Even if you're in the business of, selling bricks, the idea is that you employ people and those people have to come to work. And if they come to work healthy, they're going to work longer and be more productive and be a better employee. And therefore, they'll be able to be a more productive part of society and that business itself. And so the idea would be, how do you find and keep people that are healthy and productive and that are contributing to the business? And so all of us have an interest in essentially moving beyond our current public health sort of conception to something that's much more an everyday focus on let's live a healthy life. Now, that's the other aspect which is really important here, which is that, you know, we've gained in our life expectancy over the last century. We've gained 30 years in life expectancy, which is terrific. 25 of those 30 years came as a result of public health initiatives. And those public health initiatives stem from clean water and seatbelt use and immunizations and a whole host of other things. But the reality is that we need to change from thinking about our sick care system to keeping people healthy and well. And so that's a major focus of the Public Health 3.0.
Thank you, Paul Halverson, for that. And I would like to remind the rest of the panel, if you're not speaking, please mute your microphone. We're getting a little bit of noise on the line. Paul, I want to stay with you on this. So we just kind of took a 1,000-foot view of public health 3.0, this sort of idea, and I'm going to use your words back at you, strategically changing the culture of health in the United States. So let's bring it down to earth. Let's see a few examples of how life would look different if we implemented public health 3.0 and went in the direction you'd like to see. What would we see that's different from what we see now?
Well, I think part of what we would be focused on is prevention, for one thing. So we have the United States spends the most money per capita of nearly any other country in the world on our health system. And we get probably some of the worst health results. So we spend a lot of money. We don't get much. But remember, about 97% of all that we spend goes to a sick care system, which is focused on taking care of people who are sick rather than keeping people well. So about 3% goes to prevention and public health services, where 97% is focused on fixing people that are sick. So in a public health 3.0, we would really focus and change that around so that, in fact, the idea would be, how do we keep people healthy? And how do we create an environment in which we really put a lot of emphasis on preventive medicine, testing as appropriate so that people can understand when they're sick and get care earlier? But more than that, it's really beginning to think through, how do you create a healthy environment? How can we keep people from getting the chronic diseases that we're dying of now? And even more than dying, you know, it's not just the quantity of life, it's the quality of life, right? So, and this is one of the issues that I think we in Indiana really need to focus on, which is we're in one of the most unhealthy states in the country in Indiana. And I love Indiana. I'm a Hoosier by choice. I've moved here. My family's here. We love it here. But this is an unhealthy state. We're ranked 41st out of 50 states in our overall health status, and we've been on the decline for a long while. And part of that is—
Just 30 seconds left, Paul. Sorry.
Sure. We don't fund public health in Indiana to the extent that we need to. We're 48th out of 50 states in that regard. We need to do more to focus on keeping people healthy and improving our overall health status and quality of life. And that can be done. And we can work on that together to try to focus on changing the emphasis of public health.
And we'll talk about what that looks like after a quick break. We're talking about public health systems in Indiana and across the country and what we can learn about them by reflecting on the response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And we'll be back with the discussion in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelsert. We're talking today about a new article from researchers on the country's response to the COVID-19 pandemic and what it can tell us about our public health systems. We would love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. We have with us Brian Dixon, Director of Public Health Informatics at the Regan Streef Institute and Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the IUPUI School of Public Health. Paul Halverson is Founding Dean of the Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. And Virginia Kane is Director and Chief Medical Officer for the Marion County Public Health Department. And Virginia Kane, we didn't get to you in the last segment. I'll start with you in this segment. What are the most important points you wanted to make in this new academic article? And Virginia, your mic might be off. I can't hear you. Virginia, are you there?
Can you hear me now?
I got you now, Virginia. What would you say are the most important points you wanted to make with this article?
So I think the thing is that when we think about medicine, we think about traditional medicine. So someone comes in there for the high blood pressure, I'll talk about their high blood pressure. But we don't think about social determinants of health and how that plays a critical role for taking care of patients. And especially when we look at our vulnerable populations, because just from a poverty level, a lot of them have lost their jobs during this COVID-19 epidemic. African-Americans, for example, are in of the 8 to 10 lowest paying jobs, they don't have the luxury of staying home and do their work by telecommuting. They're usually have those frontline jobs where they have to be out there and exposed to a lot of individuals. So we need more of an investment in terms of providing these additional services if we're really going to meet the need of the individuals whenever we have a crisis. So addressing social determinants of health, and we've got to stop. We've been going the wrong direction in terms of our investment and our funding for public health. I believe CDC cut their budget last year and have continued to cut their budget by 10% in the past decade. And if you look at where we were, oh, say 20 years ago, we've drastically lost over 25% of our budget focused on public health. So things like our national federal stockpile, when this epidemic started, we didn't have personal protective equipment in order to protect our essential healthcare workers. But more important, it was the testing was not available in our vulnerable populations areas.
This is an incredibly complicated problem, of course, but we've done a lot of shows in the last 7 months on health because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so a lot of what I keep hearing repeated over and over and over again are exactly the things that you've said just now. So with that in mind, how much of a challenge, I guess, has it been to point to identify the specific issues that need to be addressed and how to prioritize them? It seems like these sorts of things, what you're talking about, have been on your mind for a long time. It's just implementing them and figuring out how to make everything work together.
So I think that's key, but you have to have resources too. Mm. So we do it the hard way and we do it piecemeal because we have not had the investment in our infrastructure, our program resources in order to carry out things. So we may not be as efficient as we could have been if we had greater investment in our public health structure. Hey, our health department went into the homeless business. You know, we didn't realize that we were going to be doing that. But it was clear that if we were going to control infections for our incarcerated individuals, our homeless population, and I can't tell you how many people have been evicted or may have, you know, not able to pay their mortgage on their house. Or just recently, we were told where we had a Latino Hispanic patient who was diagnosed with COVID-19. He informed his employer on a Friday. He was fired on a Monday. And then, so what happens? People won't tell you or tell their employers that they're positive. They'll force themselves to go back to work, maybe expose an infection to others. And so cultural languages played a role in this epidemic, higher death rates. And then you always have the problem of the issue. Do you have access to healthcare services?
Brian, it seems like we're hearing over and over again that testing failed. I mean, in the article, it says with respect to testing, multiple components of the health system failed. We have not done well enough. I mean, I know we've brought this up a couple of times already, but if we can get a little closer to it, what would you say happened?
Well, I think there were a number of factors that played a role. I think one of the biggest ones is that, you know, it took our federal CDC a long time to develop a test that they rolled out to state public health systems. So the way public health is organized in this country is that the state public health agencies kind of are on the front line of detecting, you know, new viruses as they emerge, right? Especially during a pandemic. And so that they are the testing grounds. And so when CDC took a long time to develop its test, instead of adopting the test that other countries were using, the CDC decided that it needed to develop its own test. And it took them a while to get it right and then get that out to the state health departments. And then once out in the state health departments, we found that the state health departments had limited capacity to test the population of each state. Our state health department, you know, could not, they can't run, you know, tens of thousands of tests per day. for COVID-19. And so they then had to turn to the commercial laboratories and the hospital laboratories and rely upon them to run those tests. And it took those facilities time to get up to speed because these the test, which is called a PCR test, it requires, you know, a lot of time and energy. It requires a lot of manpower to analyze the samples inside of the laboratory. And it took a lot of resources to do that. And so it took our health system, which again, fragmented and reliant upon kind of, you know, these private sector entities to get up to speed. And there's still, and even today, a lot of those companies are still trying to build capacity for the fall and winter. It's not like we have all the capacity we need right now to test every person. And so those components of our health system really kind of, you know, failed to live up to the design of them. Go ahead.
So can I pipe in? Let me just say this. You know, CDC does an incredible job. Up until this point, they've always been fantastic, very efficient, coming up with new diagnostic tests. But if you listen to the director of CDC, Robert Redfield, when he was testifying before Congress, his budget had been cut dramatically. He lost 40 well-known scientists in his public health laboratory that helps build these tests. That's institutional history and knowledge. So when you bring in new people and they're new and they don't have that level of experience, was that CDC's fault or was that the fault that they weren't provided the investment for something that might happen in the future?
Well, and if I could add in here, because I think it really, Dr. Kane is really on to something that's important, and Brian mentioned it. But I was at CDC in 2001 when we had the events of 9/11 and the anthrax and so forth. And we as a nation really geared up our public health system. We created emergency preparedness capacity, and we really acknowledge the importance of public health. But guess what? Since 2001, funding for public health has decreased by over 27%. And so our public health system, which was never strong to begin with, was bolstered by some funding in 2001 across the country. And it's been declining ever since. And so we start with a very low public health investment. And in Indiana, it's even worse. We're 48th out of 50 states in terms of our investment in public health. So when you start with a worldwide pandemic like we've just experienced, in which we're currently engaged, and you start with a very weak public health system to start with, we've got a major problem. And with in Indiana, we have perhaps some of the weakest local public health systems in the country. And it's not because we don't have great people. We have terrific people that are in public health, and they're working hard every day trying to do the very best job that they can. But this is really way beyond the ability of a very, very small typical staffing at a local health department in Indiana to absorb this kind of issue. And so as it's sort of the perfect storm that happens, we're at an all-time low in our funding. We have a number of our public health personnel that have left or retiring, many more that plan to retire. About 70% of the people working in public health today have no formal training in public health. Again, they're working very hard. They're doing the best they can. But we don't have the resources necessary to be able to effectively manage this level of an emergency. And again, thankfully in Indiana, we have a strong public health system at the state level. But even they have been stressed beyond belief in terms of being able to handle the day-to-day activities of managing a pandemic. I mean, just look at contact tracing, for example. Dr. Box made an investment across the state in electronic contact tracing. But frankly, there wasn't much of a choice because we didn't have the robust public health system that we really needed. If you look at other states that have strong local public health systems, most of those states actually have done contact tracing at a local level by local public health people that have been engaged in talking to their neighbors and the community members. But we've had to resort to a statewide telephone bank, which, you know, again, I think we're doing pretty well under the circumstances, but our public health system is really not up to the task. And I think that's the bottom line.
We're talking today about a new article from researchers on the country's response to the COVID-19 pandemic and what it reveals about our public health systems. And Paul, I'm going to stay with you for just a moment. I'm trying to get to the why, maybe why public health seems to keep getting cut. And I'll kind of start here. Can you talk about how funding for public health is actually used at the federal level? I mean, what tangible impact does it have when more funding goes to public health?
Well, a couple different branches, if you will. So one is clearly dealing with infectious diseases. And one of the principal scientific disciplines of public health is epidemiology. These are the people who are trained to be our disease detectives. They work very hard to understand where our infectious diseases are coming from. If there's an epidemic coming, they can be able to identify people that have the disease, people that are susceptible to disease, looking at disease transmission, all of those things relating to infectious diseases. But the reality is most people actually die not of infectious diseases, but of chronic diseases, things like cancer and stroke and heart disease and all of the chronic diseases, many of which are completely preventable. So that's the other part that public health does, is we work in the chronic disease area trying to help people identify ways in which to prevent the disease. Unfortunately, again, that takes time and money and expertise, and that's a lot of what we don't have. So at the federal level, again, in controlling infectious disease is also dependent upon a strong laboratory capacity. And Brian mentioned this. We have to have laboratories, public health laboratories in each of our states, and many of our large cities have public health laboratories. And we need to have the robust both equipment and the people necessary to run those laboratories, along with the epidemiologists, people that work in environmental health who can detect foodborne outbreaks, who can be involved in if there is, God forbid, a bioterrorism incident and so forth. These are people on the ground that need to be available to detect and to manage these kinds of diseases. And then at the chronic disease level, again, it's the people that work in the area of smoking, for example. Let's take that one. Here in Indiana, we're ranked 44th out of 50 states in terms of our tobacco use. And that's terrible, because tobacco is the leading cause of preventable death in this nation. And in Indiana, it is particularly difficult for us. In fact, one of the problems that we've all identified is our infant mortality. We're substantially higher than the rest of the country in infant mortality. These are our babies that die before their first birthday. And we also have a very, very high maternal mortality. That means moms who die in the first year of giving birth. And the issue for us in part is tobacco use. The people that use tobacco during pregnancy tend to have smaller babies, premature babies, and that leads to increased infant mortality. Well, some of our pregnant moms in some counties in Indiana, we have almost 40% of pregnant moms smoking. That's a real problem. And in an effective public health system, we work to try to make sure that we can help people, first of all, understand the dangers of tobacco use. And secondly, from a policy perspective, we would try to figure out a way to make tobacco so expensive that people don't smoke it and don't use it. And so whether it's the pregnant mom, or whether it's the teenager that gets hooked on tobacco, we know that if we can keep people from starting to smoke early, they generally won't smoke when they become adults. But just like, for example, let's look at tobacco prevention and control in Indiana. The CDC says that we should be spending about $72 million a year based upon our population to prevent and control tobacco. In Indiana, we spend about $7 million a year, and that's actually up from what was $3 million a year just 2 years ago. So there's a real disconnect between what's killing us and what's affecting our health and what we're investing in. And that's been part of the problem. And tobacco is a great example. The tobacco companies spend over $300 million a year trying to promote tobacco products. Plus, they spend more than that if you look at the money they spend on political campaigns and lobbyists and so forth. And they, in part, have been ones responsible for trying to keep the public investment low. That allows them to sell more products. And we know from our research that tobacco companies, for example, target minority communities and are actually focused on trying to sell more products in lower income minority areas. So that's just an example of what public health could be doing if it could be more effective, is really working to try to reduce tobacco use, which then reduces stroke and heart disease and infant mortality and maternal mortality, all of these things that all work together to rob us.
Paul, we'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with researchers about the state and the country's response to the pandemic. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Back now to our discussion on the current state of public health systems in Indiana and the country, and what some say needs to be addressed to solve both short and long-term problems. As always, we would love your questions and comments in the discussion. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. We have with us Paul Halverson, founding dean of the Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. Also Virginia Kane, director and chief medical officer for the Marion County Public Health Department. And Brian Dixon, director of public health informatics at the Regan Street Institute and associate professor of epidemiology at the IUPUI School of Public Health. And Brian, we're going to start with you in this segment. So you have expertise on technology. What role has tech played in the country's response to the pandemic? Have they leveraged it as much as they maybe should have?
Well, I think in the end, we've seen a dramatic increase in the use of technology in response to this pandemic. However, at the beginning of the pandemic, it was challenging to move data around rapidly because of the fragmented information systems and weak information systems, or antiquated information systems, I should say, that existed in many states and jurisdictions. So many places at the beginning of this pandemic were using paper or phone calls to move information around. So for example, hospitals phoning in information to the state health department every day. As the pandemic has progressed, we've seen more and more states implement information systems, which is probably the worst time in the world to implement such systems, is during a pandemic. However, the need for data and information to move quickly has necessitated many states to move in that direction. And we've even seen a lot of sort of challenges at the national level with the changing of information systems. So I would say that this pandemic has illustrated the need for us to have a robust information infrastructure to support public health. It wasn't there at the beginning of this pandemic. There are pieces and parts of it that are now in place, but we will need to continue after this pandemic to strengthen that infrastructure that exists.
I'm really kind of surprised by that. Even after all of these years of talking about moving to an electronic records system and things like that, and it seemed like things were moving in the right direction, even still at the beginning of the pandemic, we were talking about paper and phone calls and things like that. Why do you think it took a global pandemic to bring these systems along?
I think it's because we historically underinvest in the public health side. So electronic medical record systems have been implemented in healthcare delivery systems over the last 10 to 15 years. So most hospitals have electronic systems. Most outpatient clinics, your primary care doctors and your cardiologists have electronic systems. Dentists have electronic systems. But public health agencies tend to have outdated equipment and antiquated information systems that were developed in the 1970s and 80s. And so what this pandemic has highlighted is that these organizations were left out of the high-tech, you know, dollars that came from Congress in 2010, and they were left out of the national discussions around electronic health record adoption from over the last 20 years. So it's almost as if people in Congress and government kind of forgot about public health when they were writing some of that legislation. And so as a result of that, when you get to a pandemic, you've got a system that largely relies upon the fax machine that needs to now interface with the healthcare system that has electronic records.
Virginia, we got kind of a look at how funding for public health is used at the federal level and a little bit of a look at the state level when we talked to Paul in the last segment. But you're on the local level. Can you talk about how public health funding is handled there at the county level? What control do you have over how it's used?
So a lot of times we have what's called pass-through money so that we can apply for funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, but it's funneled through the State Department of Health. And so a lot of times they will set up criteria for local health departments to apply for that. Now, we do have funding that comes directly to local health. For example, our HIV funding, and we have some nutritional other reach funding. And so when it comes to us locally, it's a lot easier to coordinate those resources a little bit quicker if it comes directly to us than as opposed to through a state function. But here's our issue, at least for us for the COVID-19, when you look at the CARE dollars, and this is the main federal dollars that's targeting how you provide resources to the community, we have to always be aware. We're not like a hospital. A hospital, I'll take care of my patients while you're in the hospital. And I may tell you, wow, I think you need to eat properly for your diabetes, or I need you to walk more for your high blood pressure. So hospital systems are now just getting involved in the social determinants. They may not realize that I have a young lady that has diabetes, but based on our transit system, it may take her 45 minutes to an hour to get to the closest hospital system. And so when her provider is telling her, you know, you should really be eating right and doing better because it's going to impact your care. And she's looking at her healthcare provider with, he doesn't have a clue what's on in my situation. My closest grocery store is 1 hour. I've got to get on the bus. It's snowing into winter. It's cold. And how many groceries can I carry back to where I live? So we've got to also do better training for our providers from an implicit bias standpoint, understanding that we have got to provide these support services. So if we don't, no wonder we're not seeing an improvement in our health outcomes. So we need resources to help us address these social determinants of health. I have to find housing for over 1,000 homeless people during this COVID-19, okay? I have to provide assistance in our correctional system to help make sure that we're able to do all the testing that's needed and provide some expertise and some of our funding to assist the correctional facilities. But I love it that this community has really come together. Oh my God. The collaboration, the coordination, and the partnerships that came along with this was incredible. But never forget, our most vulnerable people, our most vulnerable racial and ethnic populations, we have to make sure that resources are going to them, okay? And it can't always be some agency providing the services to them. We have to get the grassroots organizations that have been out there providing services for a long time the public trust in order to continue to provide resources to the very people we need to reach.
We're talking about public health systems in Indiana and the country and what we can learn about them by reflecting on the response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And we're also talking specifically about an article that was written by our guests. And so, Paul, in the conclusion of this article in this academic journal, there is a quote from a research article from 2004, and it says, achieving a highly functioning governmental public health system is difficult. The necessary tasks are technically within our reach, but require political will. And there's been a lot of talk on that. Can you expand on that?
Right. So the idea here is that we know what to do. There's adequate training available. There are people that are interested in working in public health. There's technology that's available. But we need to understand the importance of making an investment now and into the future to build a strong public health system that can help us prepare for emergencies like we're in the midst of now, but also work to reduce the barriers to improved health and improve our life expectancy and our quality of life. Unfortunately, sometimes it comes down to making an investment in this whole public health enterprise. And again, that's one of the challenges that we face here in Indiana. But I'm heartened by the fact that we have people like Governor Holcomb, who has recently mentioned the importance of making a greater investment and making an improvement, making a higher priority of our public health system in Indiana. I think that will really be important if we're going to see a change. But even more important, frankly, is beginning to change the attitude of the community to focus on an expectation that our health will be good and that we don't just wait for the disease to come and then go to the doctor and expect it to be fixed, but we begin thinking about, how do we prevent disease? How can we prevent the need for the catastrophic care that we currently are focused on? So if we can really change and begin thinking about prevention, and if we can mobilize the community, it's not just what the health department does, but it's what all of us do, and creating an expectation and a culture of health, then it's pretty much an easier sell to talk about making an investment in public health when people see that investment is not just for those people, but it's for all of us. I mean, one of the things that Dr. Kane mentioned earlier was the fact that it's all about the social determinants of health. And the fact of the matter is that your zip code is probably the greatest indicator of whether or not you're going to live or die, or the quality of life that you'll have. Here in Indianapolis, for example, in the southern part of our county, we actually have a little baby born today in the southern part of our county will live on average 14 years less than that same little baby born up in Hamilton County, just less than 20 miles away. The life expectancy is so dependent upon where you live and the social determinants of health and the environment in which you are living in and working in. And so we need to change the culture, and that means making an investment, but it means also changing our expectations.
Virginia Kane, how much of a challenge is it for health experts and advocates like yourself to break into the political side of things to help make things happen? What's the biggest obstacle for them?
I think it's that public health is prevention. So we prevent a lot of things that a lot of people don't even have any eye on. It's not visible. So when things are quiet, so like when they're eating at that restaurant, they're eating that food, And it's great. They don't have a food outbreak. It's because public health's been working very hard to do those inspections. You know, if we think there's some water outbreak or lead poisoning in children, we're doing our work, but it's quietly. So we're preventing a lot of things from happening. And only when you see like H1N1 influenza outbreak, or when you see Ebola, does it come to everybody's attention. But once that dissipates, oh, I go back. I don't see the need for preparation. It's just like, wow, I'm in my car. I'm going to drive to California. They don't see the need that I needed to have kept my oil, changed my oil and my filter in my car and keeping it ready. So if I only just change that oil and filter when I'm ready to do a trip, long trip, they don't understand why we may have challenges in terms of letting them see the value of what we do.
But as Paul said, it seems like the politics, the politics definitely come into play here, and pushing for political change can be difficult if you want to be seen as apolitical or non-political or non-partisan. I mean, how difficult is it to push if you see a problem and you know that it'll require political clout? How hard is it for someone in your position or someone who is in a public health position to push for that political change?
Well, I think it's how do I say it? I don't know that it's so much as it's hard as it's a slower process to change the culture for them to have a better understanding of, you know, these are the results that I want us to do. For example, I was on talking to one of my federal legislators and trying to encourage them to say, we need more resources coming to Indiana. And the response was, well, we need to get more local support and we need to get more state report. And I wholeheartedly agreed with that. But, you know, if you pay your taxes, you expect some of your resources to come back to your state. And so trying to figure out what's that balance, how do we make it happen? And I think we also always have to look at their perspective, you know, and try to figure out where they're coming from. And so we've been successful in a number of fronts, but we have a long way to go with smoking. I want to say that one of our finest assets were Indiana Health Information Exchange, of which I was a founding member, where we're able to connect all the hospital systems data, and we're able to connect public health data with that hospital system data. I think that's been remarkable. But it's all as well, it's about leadership. So I know for the city of Indianapolis, at least, Mayor Hodgson, I think, has just done an incredible job from a leadership standpoint, and has moved us very cautiously through this process. And actually, both Governor Holcomb and both our mayors have just done an incredible job for the state of Indiana. But we do have a ways to go. And it's just from a cultural standpoint, it's just very difficult for some people to make a change. It's a sort of slower process.
We've got about a minute left, Brian. I'm going to give you about 30 seconds to answer this. You're an associate professor of epidemiology at IUPUI. How often does politics come up in the classroom? Just in a few words.
Well, politics come up all the time because we want our students to understand that if they're going out to work in public health, they will, like Dr. Kane, have to, you know, work with political leaders to make changes. And then also the students come in with a variety of perspectives from all sides of the aisle. And so we have a lot of discussions around these different perspectives. And as Dr. Kane said, the need for public health professionals to understand all sides in order to advance population health.
Brian Dixon, I want to thank you. You're Director of Public Health Informatics at Regan Streef Institute and Associate Professor of Epidemiology at IUPUI School of Public Health. We've also been joined by Paul Halverson, Founding Dean of the Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health, and Virginia Kane, Director of and Chief Medical Officer for the Marion County Public Health Department. I'm Matt Pelser. Great discussion today. Thanks for listening. This is All In.